Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Burning Bridges podcast with Mike Spriegel. This is your host, Mike Spriegel, and this is production right here. This is like two episodes within a 2 month period of time. This is crazy. I don't know how I do it. I must be on drugs at this point. Joining me today's episode is my friend and multiple time co-host, John. Say hi.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me once again.
Yes, it's fun. I need you sometimes here because I feel that you have a nice, better amount of optimism about things than me. I have been known to be cynical from time to time. So.
Yeah, I do tend to be the more glasses half full type of person.
Whereas I'm like, the glass is broken and what's inside the glass is probably poisoned and that we're all going to die if we drink from the glass.
Yes.
So, getting housekeeping out of the way, first and foremost, thank you for anybody that's been listening and downloading episodes. There's still a healthy amount of downloads, so for that, I'm always very gracious. You can always follow us on Facebook at the Burning Bridges Podcast Facebook page or on Twitter at BBridgesPod on Twitter. A few things I'd like to think, I always like to talk about are the things that I'm liking reading or drinking at the time. I am currently drinking coffee for this podcast because it's early in the day, not later in the evening. So no beer drinks or recommendations, although Third Act Brewery, where I sometimes beer tend, does have a lot of great beers that I've enjoyed. So if you're in the local Minnesota area as well as in Woodbury, by all means, feel free to stop by there. In terms of books, one book that I've been reading, which is really great, is the Beastie Boys book, which is the autobiography written by the surviving members of the Beastie Boys, Michael Diamond and... oh, dear God, why am I just blasting Adam Horowitz? Unfortunately, you know, the third member, MC Adam Yauch, he died about several years ago due to cancer. So it's an interesting perspective, and you can see how much the guys love and miss him not being there for his perspective of the book itself. But you get a lot of amazing insights just about how the band evolved, and for them, how so many things for them was a joke in a lot of ways, and then... but nonetheless trying to be serious in the same time as well. So, great book right there. What about you, John? What are you reading, drinking, or doing?
I am also drinking coffee because of the early hour. I haven't been doing much. We did get a Switch for the holidays for the family, and as behind the times as I am, I've been playing Hollow Knight quite a bit on there lately, and that's been pretty good. It's a Metroidvania-type game that is... pretty darn frustrating if you're not used to how challenging old school video games can be. This will certainly be an eye opener for you, but it's been a lot of fun. I haven't been reading a whole lot lately. I'm hoping to get back on that now that the holidays are behind us and catch up on some stuff. But yeah, that's about it for now.
Yeah, we also got a Switch for the holidays for the kids, and Xander, my son, he's been playing Smash Brothers Ultimate and Let's Go Pikachu, and I have not touched it once.
Yeah, I picked up Smash Brothers. That'll be my son's birthday present in a few weeks here. So, spoilers if he happens to listen to this podcast. You're getting Smash Brothers, Alec.
Yeah, don't spoil it for him. That would be really messed up. So, yeah. Otherwise, today's topic of the podcast is kind of a one that it's divisive in a lot of ways. And what the topic is talking about the four Batman movies that happened between 1989 to 1998. That includes Tim Burton's Batman, Batman Returns, and then the Schumacher Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. And a lot of people always talk about what killed the Bat franchise, but I don't think they give the franchise enough credit for doing what it did for Batman. Yes, there's some very bad things that happened throughout these four movies, but we kind of give at least a backstory in case you have not heard of Batman because you've been living in a fallout shelter for about the past 70 years. Batman, created back in the 40s by Gil Kane and Bill Finger, artist and writer, basically about a millionaire, or now billionaire. Back then, millionaire was much more impressive, but now he's billionaire. Who knows, maybe like now, in a couple years, we could say Bruce Wayne's a trillionaire, just to try to up his credit and everything. But it was about a billionaire who's lost his parents when he was young, so he became a vigilante, was inspired by bats. And throughout the entire 40s and 50s, there were various radio and TV serials of Batman that exploited him. And Batman was popular, but he wasn't really over the top. It was just something that happened. They had like Superman was the same way. They had various radio shows and serials, and he was just a character. But they kind of just, you know, always like he had a niche of being just, you know, this cartoon comic character. Batman then went through kind of a renaissance in the 60s, and that's when the notorious Batman television show came on, which was probably one of the most campiest things that have ever been put on the television at that time. But that, I think, set the tone for what a lot of people thought remembered about Batman for that period of time, was this cheesy, hokey kind of guy where, you know, Batman had every single answer and solution on his utility belt, and Robin said holy this and holy that, and it became kind of just what the trademark was for Batman and what he was known for a period of time.
Yeah, not even just for Batman, I would say. I mean, these days, at least, it's kind of bled over to, like, comic books in general. I mean, you still to this day see newspaper headlines that say, Biff, Bam, Pow, Comics Make a Return, and stuff like that, which was, you know, a big hallmark of that show as well.
Exactly. I mean, that show had a tremendous amount of influence, and Batman, over the decades from that point right there, from the 60s on, I would say he got progressively darker. He still had presence in cartoons where you would see him team up with Scooby-Doo, and then there was the, you know, not the Justice League, but the Superheroes cartoon where, Super Friends cartoon, two different versions of that where you saw him working alongside against either the Legion of Doom or Darkseid, depending on which cartoon you were watching. But the comic itself got progressively darker as the comic went in the 70s. That's when they started introducing characters like, and I'm sure you can probably grill me for however you want me to pronounce this, Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, I think Ra's al Ghul is generally how most people pronounce it, but I don't think anybody's going to chide you too much for pronunciation on that one.
There's somebody. It's the internet. Somebody's going to chide me for this, but yeah, Ra's al Ghul that was introduced, and you started getting some of these, like, you know, more, as I said, just a lot more mythical storylines that Batman got introduced into. And before Batman, the 1989 movie came out, there was a lot of great Batman stories written, which would heavily influence what Tim Burton would do with this movie. Because you had The Dark Knight that came out in 1986. You had, in 1988, you had Alan Moore's Killing Joke that came out.
Yeah, there's also Year One was right around that same time. Like the trilogy of, you know, Batman's epic stories are right in that kind of neck of the woods of time.
But all of them took a much, much more adult tone in terms of both content and violence and darkness, but also the portrayal of Batman being this, like, merciless detective. You know, before, like, Batman was always considered more lighthearted or in some ways just goofier. Yeah, he was a detective, but the way, like, in the TV show, they always portrayed him back in the 60s, like, weird leaps of conclusion and how he would figure out and determine, you know, why the Riddler was the one behind it. It's like, well, the letter C is in this, because the letter C is in this, that means Riddler. And like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he definitely got a bit more serious, a bit more down to earth, I think, in the mid to late 80s.
And what's more interesting is the fact that Tim Burton being the director of the 1989 Batman movie, because with that, he was coming off a few of his great hit movies, such as Pee-wee's Big Adventure back in 85. He had Beetlejuice in 88. So he already had some movies under his belt. So for them to give him the reins of the Batman universe, and I'll say this, is that one of the reasons why I feel Batman had such a great revival was because of Tim Burton's vision of what Gotham City looked like. It was truly this gothic and dark and bleak place. It looked like a place you did not want to visit.
Yeah, I think that set the tone even going forward into today. Gotham is this very, like you said, gothic and just dark place with just ominous buildings and huge spires. And a lot of that came from Tim Burton.
And I think the other aspect of where Batman 1989 came from, too, is that as the movie was, there was a lot of action movies coming out within years of that. And those movies had, once again, very violent tones. That was kind of what the late 80s was about. You had movies like Predator, you had RoboCop, you had Lethal Weapon, you had Total Recall, you had all of these movies where there's just dark action, violence. This movie isn't different from it. What makes this weird is that the first Batman movie, is it a movie about Batman?
It's hard to say. It's kind of all over the place. I mean, Batman's definitely there, but you do, I think, feel like when you examine it a little bit more, he's not really the main focus. I think that goes to Joker. I would say it's almost the evolution of his character.
The first Batman movie, it was a complete renaissance. Like, that summer of 1989, Batman went from being this character people maybe knew about to being everywhere. You would see Batman, you know, the old TV show made it back onto the, you know, the TV airwaves. You had Batman toys, Batman shirts. The Batman logo was everywhere, which was, you had also the benefit of Prince, and this is what's even more absurd, is Prince doing the soundtrack for the entire Batman movie.
Yeah, which, it kind of harkens back to Queen doing the Flash Gordon soundtrack, because every song on there was a Prince song.
It was, and some of it made sense, like when you watch the movie, but then there's other times it just felt weird. Like one of the more iconic scenes that I remember from like the Batman movie is the Party Man scene where Joker gasses the restaurant where Vicky's at, and then him and his goons go and vandalize all the art while Prince's Party Man's playing in the background. And I sit there and think about it, and it's like, you know what? You couldn't do that scene with a different song. That song actually kind of fit perfectly in there. But in your same mind, you're also like, Prince is writing this songs for a Batman movie. I mean, it's, this, in some ways, you have to wonder, how much was it of a gamble for the studio? Because you had a Batman movie being directed by Tim Burton, whose previous, you know, movies were definitely very outlandish, to say the least. You have Prince, who was one of the most well-known and respected rockers of the time, contributing a weird array of songs. And if you don't believe it's weird, try listening to the Bat Dance song. Now pull it up on you. You can pull it up on YouTube. Before you couldn't, but when Prince died,
yeah, it's a little weird.
All the music rights allowed now where you can find the song easily accessible online just to stream if you need to. And it's just an ape crazy song of just...
Yeah, it's kind of a weird, like you were saying, how this movie got made in the different parts. Like, I feel like Warner Brothers let Tim Burton make this movie because they're like, well, it's Batman. I mean, if he screws it up, you know, at the time, it was no big loss. If he screws it up, it's only Batman. Who cares? But then you see them put Prince on there, like you said, who's this big heavyweight of a musical artist. And I almost wonder if Prince didn't approach them, because I know he's got some, you know, more geeky tendencies than he tends to let on generally.
No, I remember reading about this, that they did approach Prince about doing this. They wanted to tie a superstar to the actual soundtrack itself. And during the making of the movie, he was actually writing the songs alongside the production of the movie itself. Hmm. That helped try to almost, you know, tie into some of, you know, what was going on there. There's also word that he probably may have slept with Kim Basinger at the time, which, he's Prince. That sounds very legit and what Prince would probably do. So, but it was a weird movie, and it's weird in the sense that Batman and Bruce Wayne are both barely in the movie, I would say. I would say if there was an official number, and if I were to pull it up, I think, like, in terms of total screen time, he only got, like, about 30, maybe 27 to 30 minutes of screen time out of, like, the whole hour to, like, 45-minute movie or so.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he's definitely there, but like I said, it's almost, he's almost got more of a supporting role in his own movie.
And I think if I, you know, when I was thinking about and planning out this, you know, what, you know, the podcast itself, I mean, there was only really four scenes with Batman, maybe five tops, because you have the opening scene where there's the two muggers and then Batman, you know, beats them up. And that's a loose term because Batman gets, like, shot by them. And then
his big rubber, whatever the heck that is, armor that he's wearing.
Right, his big move is this, is I'm going to swoop down, but I'm going to get shot. I'll take a couple of the hits there, and when they come, then I'll get back up again. Like, Batman, you could almost probably switch up Batman in that movie with The Undertaker, where he would take this massive amount of damage, but then, like, The Undertaker would just sit right up out of nowhere, and it's like, oh, hey, he's okay. So, you mean you have that scene right there. There's the scene where Batman, you know, like, fights the Joker, or not, Jack Napier and his goons in the chemical factory. Yeah. You have Batman where he rescues Vicky Vale from the restaurant. And then after that, really, you don't see Batman again until you get to the near end of the movie where he's, you know, going towards the final showdown with the Joker at that point. So, I mean, that's four scenes with the Batman right there. You get more scenes with Michael Keaton as Batman, and that's even more weirder, some of the Keaton scenes, because you have the Keaton scene where, like, all right, he's in the mansion where he's having, like, the fundraiser of some sort, And it's great because you have asshole Michael Keaton, because, you know, everybody, like, even Vicky Vale is like, you know where Michael Keaton is? No, no idea where he is. You know, just kind of just playing it aloof and everything. You have, like, Michael Keaton where, you know, he's dropping off the flowers in front of the, you know, like, crime alley, and then that's where the Joker kills all the other mobsters.
What I think, too, speaking of Michael Keaton, you almost, it's, speaking of the odd things with this movie, is he was a comedic actor, and then all of a sudden they cast him to play Batman in this thing. I remember, I didn't really, wasn't aware of it at the time, but that was a huge controversial thing. Like, if the internet was around back then, the internet would have been on fire with people saying, how dare you cast Michael Keaton, this comedic actor, as Batman, and people were just outraged, I guess. And to be fair, I think he did a fairly decent job, and most people think he did a fairly decent job, I think. But at the time, it was definitely an odd decision.
I would say the one scene in the first Batman that doesn't make any sense and that just seems really weird is the one scene where Keaton, Bruce Wayne goes to Vicky Vale's apartment, but then the Joker shows up. And then there's that weird scene where, like, Bruce Wayne starts acting, you want to get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Yeah, it's almost like he's trying to play mind games with him or something. It's kind of a weird.
It's like, because part of me is like, is he trying to goad the Joker into shooting him and then hoping that whatever piece of, like, platter that he put under his coat was going to absorb the shot? I mean, in that hoping also that the Joker wasn't going to take a headshot either at that point.
Yeah, that seemed like a very odd moment.
It seemed like that one of those things that everything had to go a specific way for Bruce Wayne. And it did, and it got even weirder because then, you know, after the scene's done, that's where Vicky Vale's like, oh, Bruce is not dead, he's gone, wait, what? And then that's where it segues into, like, I think within, like, 15, 20 minutes then, Alfred just letting Vicky Vale into the Batcave, like, hey, look, yeah, here he, did you know you're dating Batman? You are. It's cool, huh? Look, there he is. And then it's like, oh, that makes sense why you're the way you were, like, how after I slept with you, I woke up and you were hanging upside down, swinging like a bat.
Yeah, that was another strange part.
Yeah, it's just these weird behaviors that they had, like Bruce Wayne and Batman do. But that's just the thing, is that's such a small part of the movie because, like, almost like the first half of the movie is establishing how the Joker became the Joker. But not only that, but because of this weird power struggle between him and Boss Grissom, which was played by Jack Palance.
Yeah. It's almost like you get, nowadays, you get the first superhero movie is the superhero origin story. But this one, instead of being the Batman origin story, the Batman origin almost gets glossed over, done really quickly, and you spend most of the movie doing the Joker origin story.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing that makes perfect sense is that, all right, the Joker right now is sleeping with Grissom's, like, you know, wife, woman. I don't know what the situation with that was, but, you know, he's with her, and then so Grissom sets up the Joker, and then the Joker falls into a vat of chemicals, which disfigures him. So where things make sense is that he then tries to get revenge on Grissom, which he successfully does pretty quickly. And yeah. That doesn't surprise me. He takes out Grissom, then he eliminates all the other mob competition. That makes kind of sense, too, based on what we saw of it. But then where it goes off the track from there is then, what's the Joker's motivation from that point? Then it's along the lines, well, I've done all this. What am I going to do now? I really like that Vicky Vale. I'm going to pursue that. But I'm going to put a tack on that. And before going after Vicky Vale, let's put a bunch of chemicals in somehow various random products that are being shipped across Gotham City that cause people to burst out into laughter until they die. And it's a weird motivation because you go from a methodical and angry Joker, and then it's like, well, I might as well just go crazy if I'm going to go with this. And he does this as, I guess, his primary plot until Bruce Wayne and Batman detectives his way in, like, it's not just one thing, it's the combination of various things. If you combine deodorant with hairspray, then this is what causes the chemical reaction.
Yeah, it's a really weird subplot because you don't really get any motivation from the Joker as to why he's doing it, and all of a sudden Batman suddenly solves it, but they don't really show him doing any of the work of solving it. He just kind of comes out with that explanation, and it's a really odd kind of ham-fisted.
It almost seems like the Joker's motivation is, I'm going to take over the mob, which seems financial. But then he veers off. It's like, you know what? I really hate Gotham City. You know, and then after that plot goes, well, I'll throw a parade for Gotham City, and then I'll have this poison gas and all the balloons. And all of a sudden, like, the Joker went from being a mob boss into, like, this genocidal individual, which was also trying to bang Vicky on the side, which...
Well, which, to be fair, I mean, the Joker, I mean, like, in the comics, is kind of portrayed as doing crazy, weird things like that every now and then, but it just seemed like they couldn't keep him kind of focused on one thing. Like you said, he took over the mob, and that all made sense, and all of a sudden he did these... You know, it's almost like he had three different schemes going on, but didn't have a good explanation for most of them.
Right. It's just this odd thing. The other subplot, then, that's also tacked into the movie as well, is you have Robert Wool as Alexander Knox, who's helping Vicki Vale try to determine who, that's or right, figure out who Batman is. See, that's... John here has not seen the Batman movies in a while, and that's why I wanted to kind of have him, you know, talk about this, is because... There's going to be a lot of these moments where I bring up something where I'm sure you're going to respond with it. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, Batman, the original one is easily the one I've seen the most. The other one's not near as much. But, yeah, even I forgot about Knox.
One credit I'll give, one person that's written a lot about Batman is Chris Sims, who has written comics, written for various comic, you know, websites. And one of his things that he brought up, which is a very interesting point, is that Alexander Knox is Robert Wool's character, is the true hero of Batman. Because here's an individual that's trying to find out who Batman is. He's being extremely supportive of Vicky, despite the fact that she wants nothing to do with him, even though he wants to get with her. Even, like, when the Joker at the end is, like, trying to, like, gas the town, he goes all vigilante, grabs a baseball bat, and he's sitting there trying to fight off, like, yeah, all the gang members.
Yeah,
he beats
off some of the goons, yeah.
And it's an interesting thing, but the bad thing then is, like, he just disappears. And, like, at the end of Batman, essentially, it's like Vicky's like, oh, well, I'm dating Batman. And then Alexander Knox kind of just fades into obscurity. And the Joker dies because, you know, back then they weren't even considering sequels. Like, yeah, we can kill him, right? And it's like, well, it's a late 80s movie, almost 90s. Yeah, we got to kill the bad guy.
Kill the villain, yep.
So, you know, they kill the Joker. And really, like, when you hear about a lot of the production stories about just the things like that, like, a lot of, like, the things that Jack Nicholson said were, like, ad-lib throughout the entire movie. And it doesn't surprise me. Like, you know, this town needs an enema. And they're like, oh, that's not in the script. Well, we'll run with it. All right. Yeah. Good one there, Jack. You did well. And he's like, that's good because I don't do second takes. And it's like, oh, okay. We got it there, Jack. Thanks. Now, there was another aspect of this movie that really just seems kind of off in a lot of ways. The fact that also the movie decides to make Jack Nicholson's Jack Napier the murderer of Bruce's parents.
Yeah, that was definitely an odd choice.
In the comic book, the original killer, well, and this has been retconned, I think, at this point,
yeah,
too.
A few times.
The original killer was a thug named Joe Chill that, you know, mugged and robbed them. But then it was retconned that it wasn't Joe Chill, that it was someone else. And but in the movie, they have the Joker do it and be the motivation for why, I guess, Batman eventually has it more personal going against Jack Napier.
Yeah, he eventually figures it out because he uses the same catchphrase all the time. And
yeah, do you dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? And
yeah.
I ask as all my victims, and it sounds cool, but what the hell does it mean at this point? But yeah, I mean, I felt that they kind of had to do that to find a way to make Batman angry at the Joker, I guess.
Yeah, which you don't really need to do, because, I mean, Batman should be angry at the Joker just because he's the Joker and he's a criminal, and that's kind of Batman's whole, you know, modus operandi is get criminals.
Is it, though? Because Batman's killing a lot of people in this movie.
He does kind of go nuts. He blows up an entire chemical factory at one point.
Right, he blows up a chemical factory, and sure, maybe there was bad guys in there, but it didn't feel like a very due process kind of thing for Batman to do, to just blow up, you know.
Well, yeah, not to mention just the loss of life, but also that, you know, blowing up chemicals, like, pollution-wise and safety-wise, just doesn't seem like a very good idea.
Well, that was also the other weird thing, too, because remember, when the balloons are there, Batman's plan to get rid of the balloons is to use his bat jet to just rounds up all the balloons, and then he just releases them.
Yeah, he kind of just drops them into space. Now,
well, was it space or...
Well, just low orbit, I should say, yeah. He kind of just brings it up to, like, maybe airplane height, you know, altitude.
And part of it, too, is this, is that, all right, if maybe it makes sense, the wind's blowing it, so this is going to go over the ocean. You don't know if there's innocent boats or anybody that's out on the ocean itself. I mean, it was a weird kind of like, oh, it's not in Gotham, not my problem anymore.
Yeah, pretty much.
So As movies go, though, this was probably one of the movies that helped bring Batman. And I talked to John about this through text last night when we were kind of discussing some minor things. And I feel this movie right here was the movie that made Batman the original Chuck Norris. Because Chuck Norris got found his way into culture where everybody, he basically became like a meme or a joke where it's like, Chuck Norris could sneeze and he can kill you, or Chuck Norris does this, or you can't beat Chuck Norris. I feel this is where the start of where the Batman is the most badass character in the world began, was because of this. This was despite the fact that Batman had limited mobility. He seemed to always be getting his ass kicked in this movie. Like, there was another time, like, you know, you remember he was suspended with Vicky, and then he releases so she can escape. And then basically he's on the ground, you know, just completely crippled, where somebody's able to lift up his mask. But I don't know. It's just weird that it always just feels like Batman was always, just getting beat up. Of course, the most badass Batman murder that Batman did is, remember when Batman, like, there was in the bell and the guy was looking where he was, and then Batman did a Frankensteiner Hurricane Rana on the guy and flipped him, basically.
Crushes his skull into this huge bell, and then lets him fall down the shaft, doesn't
he? Yeah, he does. He just lets him plummet all the way down to the shaft itself. So this was what I think reintroduced Batman back into modern culture and helped, I think, bring like the darker comic book aspect of it into the forefront. Later that year, another comic that came out was Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum, too, which was, once again, you started seeing all these stories, like darker stories, that not only enriched and empowered Batman, but also took his goofier villains and gave them, I think, darker or more sinister purposes for the most part. Now, this came out in 1989. I remember when I first saw this movie, it was in the drive-in. It was the same, it was double billing, was this and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
One of those movies is definitely better than the other.
Which one?
I prefer Last Crusade. I think that's a good one.
You know what's funny? It's on Netflix now. I just watched that yesterday.
Yeah? Nice.
Yes. They just put all the Indiana Jones movies on there, and I put it on in the background, and it's hard because if you were to ask, and this is a whole separate podcast right there, what's the best Indiana Jones movie? A lot of people say it's Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you have, I think, a lot of people that say it's The Last Crusade, and it's hard. I feel that there's more fun and enjoyment in The Last Crusade, but the sense of adventure and the stakes feel much more, I think, in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I think Raiders definitely got that more pulpy serial action type thing that they were going for.
Right. I think, you know, what Burton was going with when he was going with, this, he was going for a more noir-style Batman, more of an older, grittier kind of Batman. It's just weird because then it just, as I said, it feels like he became more enamored with, the Joker as a character, and then Batman kind of just fell in the forefront. The interesting thing, like, I remember other marketing things. Like, I remember the toys. And they only made 3 action figures, I think, for this. They had Batman and Robin. Or not Batman and Robin. Batman, Joker, and then Bob the Goon.
Bob the Goon, yep.
Because there's a character in the...
You'd go to Target and find 1,000 of him.
Right, you'd find tons of Bob the Goons. Bob the Goon was like Joker's henchman and did all his dirty work. Until, for some reason, the Joker unceremoniously killed him.
Yeah, he just kind of shoots him in the middle of the parade, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it was around the parade scene. He just shoots Bob, and it's like, well, that's harsh. Bob's been doing some quality work for you.
And Bob did good work, and then I think it was right after Batman took the balloons, and he got pissed off, and he asked Bob for a gun, and then he shoots him with it.
Yeah, he goes, Bob, gun, and then just shoots Bob, and it's like, oh, Bob, no.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's not like, you know, you work in the mob, you're going to get a retirement package. And
no, yeah.
You're also working for a guy that's trying to poison and literally murder the majority of Gotham City. So you have to feel that at some point your boss is probably going to turn on you.
You kind of know what you're signing up for there.
Right. So that's kind of just how Batman came along. It was this huge hit, and then it would go on, and they said, well, we definitely have to make a sequel. And they made a sequel, and I will say this. I feel that the sequel, in so many ways, is so much better than the original. And this is probably just me, but there's a specific reason. So, the recap what the sequel was. Back in, like, about 3 years later, 1992, they had Batman Returns. They bring back Michael Keaton as Batman. They do not bring back Kim Basinger as Vicki Vale and basically have a throwaway line about how she found out about him, but have no explanation what happened to Vicki Vale, so Batman probably killed her.
Very likely.
Most likely. And then you have 2 to 3 villains in the movie, because you have the introduction of Catwoman, you have the Penguin, and then you have my favorite villain.
Was it Max Schreck? Is that his name?
Max Schreck, right? From Christopher Walken. Who honestly has probably some of the best lines in the entire movie that only Christopher Walken can do.
Yeah.
Now, this is also another weird movie because it comes down to what's the character motivations at this point. Now, Batman, I think the nice thing in this movie is they basically just let Batman be Batman. It's like, all right, Batman's just reacting to the emergence of these new villains. The Batman doesn't have any sort of weird subplot. And really outside of, like, I kind of like this, you know, Selina Kyle. Maybe I should hook up with her. But outside of that, Batman is just going along being Batman at that point.
Yeah, and this is where I start to not remember as much because I've definitely not seen this one in quite a while. Probably a good, like, 25 years or so.
So then this is the fun parts here, to talk about the things that maybe you forgot about. Do you remember at the beginning of the movie that Pee Wee Herman was the Penguin's dad?
And I do remember that. They like abandon him because he's born and he's all freakish looking, so they throw him in the sewers or something?
They drop him into in a park, like in a bridge that goes over like a river or a pond, and they drop him there. And then he is found by the circus gang.
Yes.
And then from there, it's like that South Park joke of, like, you know, part one, meet up with circus freaks. Part two, we have no idea what happens in that period of time. But then part three, criminal gang. You know, it's just that weird aspect right there. But yeah, you had Pee Wee Herman in there. And what was, I think, even more interesting, because that was Pee Wee Herman after he got caught in Sarasota, Florida, exposing himself.
Yeah, I think this was one of the first roles he had after that.
Right. And Tim Burton, you know, he worked with him previously with Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So I can see how Tim and like, you know what, it doesn't matter. You can be in this movie. That's perfectly fine. But so, I mean, that was where you had kind of the weird start of the Joker itself. But then you fast forward to where, like, then the clown gang is, like, you know, attacking the city. But Penguin's kind of in the background at that point. Then what's weird about this is where when Batman's fighting the clown gang, he is openly murdering people.
Does he? What does he do?
All right, so I'm going to mention a few scenes here. Like, one scene was there were some jugglers that were, like, juggling these flaming bowling pins that were on stilts. Batman takes the Batmobile, apparently has a way to pivot and turn it like a 180, and then uses the turbine jet engines to burn the jugglers. And the jugglers are on fire. Then there was when Batman was fighting the strongman. He took a bomb that he got from a previous clown person, affixed it to the guy's stomach, kicked him into like an open sewer grate. Then you see a giant explosion. So where we were hypothetically thinking that, you know, he was murdering people in the Ace Factory in the first movie, no, he's literally murdering people
in right. pretty horrific ways.
So, and this would actually come to be one of the big reasons why Tim Burton wouldn't come back for the third movie, is that he only made 2 movies. They didn't bring him back for the third because this one didn't do as well. And what they were pinpointing as the reason why is that they felt that it wasn't getting good responses from the families because of all the violence. But I would say this. The first Batman, Joker electrocutes a guy into cinder. He clearly murders people on a regular basis. I can't see how his form of violence versus what was going on in this was really any different. So I think Burton got kind of scapegoated on this one, but yeah, Batman straight up murdering people, and then we're introduced to the Penguin, where it's like, oh, I'm a freak, but all I want to do is make a difference. I love Gotham, and I just want to find out who my parents were. And so you'd sit there and think, all right, so is the motivation for the Joker to find out who the parents were, and then, I guess, kill all the firstborn in some sort of weird religious callback to, like,
yeah, Passover.
Right. It's so the joke, or I keep saying the Joker. I gotta stop doing that. The Penguin just has like these weird motivations because it gets more complicated. So we have Max Schreck. So Max Schreck, he's trying to negotiate with Bruce Wayne about power. And there's some weird subplot about, you know, where Shrek's trying to build these extra things that will steal power from Gotham.
Yeah, he's like an electric or like the power company mogul or something.
But he
like
owns
that.
A department store.
He does, that's right.
Remember, he has Shrek's department store. That's the weird thing, is like he has his hands on a lot of things. And then that's where the creation of Catwoman comes from, where Selina Kyle discovers that, well, wait a minute, you're not creating power, you're just stealing power. And once again, I don't get how this benefits him in any shape or form. Or what's he going to do with all the stolen power that he has?
Yeah, sell it back to the city, or...
It gets weird, but apparently it's enough to make him shove Selina Kyle out the window, and then she gets traumatized, and then there's cats, and she...
They lick her back to life or something?
I don't know, but then she goes home and realizes, man, this vinyl suit's ugly. What if I made it into a skin-tight vinyl suit, or leather, or whatever it is? And that becomes her motivation, because then it gets weirder, because then she shows up, you know, and is like, oh, I don't remember what happened, but now I'm all confident and sexy and all of this, and... You know, Max Shack's like, I don't know what her game is, but if she tries coming to anything, I'll push her out a higher window. And that was a great Shrek line from that one right there. But, and that's just the thing, is like, all right, Selina Kyle's motivation in the movie is she wants revenge on Shrek. Here's where it gets derailed. So Shrek basically says, I see the Penguin. What? I can't get these things approved, needed for me for my overall arcing master plan of stealing Gotham's power. So if I can get the Penguin elected mayor as a proxy, then what's going to happen then is then he'll give me the ability to do what I need to do what this does. And then it gets weirder, because then at some point, like, Catwoman fights Batman, but then Batman shuns her, so she decides to team up with the Penguin, which is weird because the Penguin's working with Max Shrek, who Catwoman does not like.
It's almost like nobody knows what's going on in this movie, even the people in the movie.
Right, so I mean, that's where the movie just has this weird series of just odd motivations. You basically you see Bruce Wayne trying to romance Selina Kyle, and really that's the only extent you tend to see of it. Is that in his scenes that he had with Shrek early on. You see a lot more Batman in this movie, but this is, I think, also started the huge phase that every superhero movie has to have multiple villains, because you just can't have one.
Yeah, so this one has three, or two and a half or something.
Two and a half, I would say, but going on from this point forward, everything from the Spider-Man movies to the Daredevil movies to the X-Men movies, you never had just one bad guy anymore. You had like multiple bad guys. Now with this movie, it really goes off the rails halfway through them, or even a little bit more than halfway through the movie. And the reason why is because the Penguin right now is on his way of getting elected, until Batman plays back some recorded footage, because the Penguin's trying to apparently frame the Batman for murder. Batman turns the tables on him, and then he also plays a CD player like a DJ and scratches the CD.
So that's how CDs work.
Exactly, that is how CDs work. So then the Penguin says, well, screw it, I just want to destroy all the firstborns. So he starts capturing all the firstborns. He somehow figured out how to acquire missiles and take said missiles and put them on Penguins, and then was going to have the Penguins, I don't know, destroy Gotham?
Yeah, that's where, like you said, it really goes off the rails there.
Yeah, that's where the Penguins' plan's all over the place. Selina still seems refocused on trying to hurt both Batman and Shrek, until she finds out that Bruce and Batman are the same character. Matter of fact, there's that scene when they're dancing where she's like, well, does this mean we have to fight? And it's kind of an amusing meta scene where it's like, yeah, you kind of now know. Do you fight? What goes on from here? Then Shrek kills the Penguin, if I'm correct, because he shoots him.
Yeah, I think so. Down in the sewers or something.
Yeah, he shoots him, and like the Joker pulls the wrong umbrella. And then like the robotic or the Penguins then drag him into a eulogy style.
Yeah, that's a really weird part, is the Penguins are suddenly like aware of what's going on, and they're mourning, and it's really strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird clusterfuck of just what the hell is going on at this point in the movie. And then Shrek's in the sewers and he encounters both Bruce and Selena. And then, like, Bruce, because identity be damned, takes his mask off. And, you know, then Shrek knows that Bruce, I don't even understand why he did that. I mean, because she already knew that he was Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, because the movie needed more drama or something. I don't know.
I think he took his mask off to try to remember, hey, I'm Bruce Wayne. I still care and love for you. And then Selena Kyle electrocutes both her and Max Shrek with that open power conduit.
Yeah, because remember, doesn't his hair like go all crazy?
Yeah, he has like his frizzy hair and this skeletized face, and then she's gone. And you see her silhouette then at the end of the movie, like, ah, but she's not gone, is she? And
even though we never see her again in any other movies.
Right. So Batman Returns, I think the reason I like it more than the first one is that the Joker, everybody talks about how the Joker, Jack Nicholson's Joker, is one of the most iconic characters of all time in terms of who portrayed the Joker. Then that's until, of course, Heath Ledger came along, you know, a decade ago, and everybody's like, oh, wait a second, yeah, that's a much better Joker. But that was the measure I think everybody was trying to go up to. The problem was is that I don't feel that Jack Nicholson was as much playing the Joker as he was just ad-libbing his way through the movie. Danny DeVito, he's actually very good at being, like, just a complete creepy asshole.
Yeah, for some reason, Danny DeVito does creepy really well, and he just... Which is kind of what they're going for with Penguin.
Like, there's that one scene where, like, they have, like, the whole election team, and the one guy was talking about, you know, Penguin, like, struggling with his, like, disabilities. And I remember, like, the Penguin's response was, well, at least I don't have a broken nose. And they're all laughing, because I don't get it. And then he just breaks his nose.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where it's just those moments, like, you know what? That endears you that, yeah, this guy is a bad guy, but he's got a sense of humor about it and everything. Selena Kyle as as Catwoman kind of just is there. She's basically a mousy girl until she suffers massive head trauma and then becomes crazy. Yeah,
she's almost there more as a love interest than anything else, basically, because I don't know that she's strictly necessary for most of the rest of the plot. I think Batman and Bruce Wayne can still do what they do with Shrek without needing her to, you know, kind of help him along.
And honestly, Shrek, Christopher Walken's probably the MVP of the movie, where he takes a lesser character and somehow manages, like, to out-act almost every other character in the movie itself.
Because he's Christopher Walken. That's his superpower.
That is his superpower itself. So this movie came out, more toys are made, but the movie didn't make as much money. Now, there was still a lot of, you know, the trademark Burton-esque things that you saw in the movie itself. These first two movies, I think, help set up Batman as probably being one of the most favorite and most badass characters of all time, despite the fact the movies really didn't make sense. But there's one other thing that happened in 1992 that I think galvanized Batman as being the best there is. And what was that?
I'm going to assume you're referring to the animated series.
That came out three, four months after this movie came out, and I feel that a lot of people consider that to be probably one of the most iconic Batman performances. I mean,
yeah, that's hard to argue with Kevin Conroy as Batman and Mark Hamill as Joker. It's just the design of it all, the storytelling, the just everything top to bottom. It's kind of hard, you know, when people say this is the definitive version of Batman, it's really hard to argue against that.
Well, when you watch that Batman cartoon series too, they almost make it feel like it was set in, like, the 50s, or you see things like blimps, you see, like, all these old-style, like, you know, police cars.
Yeah, they do a good job of blending that kind of old retro Art Deco-type feel, but still having it be, you know, set in a more modern world.
But I feel that almost the Batman animated series did a better job of building this old-timey feel world than Dick Tracy ever did as a movie.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. If you haven't seen any of it, you definitely, I think you can find it somewhere out there. It's definitely worth checking it out.
It was just released on Blu-ray this past year, the complete collection itself. It ran for 3 years, and then Kevin Conroy would go on and do other variations of Batman's voice for other DC-based cartoons. But that, I think, is what, if you were like a child or a kid, you clung on to in terms of, hey, this is the Batman that's, you know, everybody knows and loves. I think another thing that also, and I think it was like a year or two after that as well, The other thing that I think also helped galvanize Batman as being one of the most badass people in the world, and I don't think it was the movies. I would say the animated series is one of it. I think the other thing was Grant Morrison's JLA comic.
Yeah, that you might have something there. I'm not sure timing on that wise. I'm not sure exactly when that came out, but
I want to say it was 94, 95.
It could be. It's probably older than I'm thinking it is. But Morrison did definitely like to play up that Batman is a god type person. He is undefeatable. He can beat, with enough planning, he can defeat anybody or anything despite whatever odds.
Well, there was Grant Morrison, and then there was one other writer also, because Morrison was the one that wrote, like, you know, back in the mid-90s, he wrote the Justice League, and he had where Batman took down an entire group of Martians on his own, or how Batman calculatedly took down, like, all these brilliant people, and he really did a great job of setting up Batman as the master manipulator. When Grant Morrison left the series, the story arc that was after that was written by Mark Waid, and that was the Tower of Babel one, and that's where it was disclosed that Batman had secret files and how to take down each member of the JLA.
Yeah, and that still gets referenced to this day in different versions of Batman, you know, of him, you know, being this master manipulator, having all these secret plans, and, you know, he's a hero, but can you trust him? Is he really your friend? And, you know, play him up as kind of this master manipulator type person.
So I feel that the first two Batman movies did a great job of jump-starting and putting Batman back in the limelight. I feel that it was the animated series as well as then his portrayal on the comics from that point forward that helped, you know, then set it up that Batman became basically the comic book variation of Chuck Norris, where he could just take down anybody at that point. So that's a lot. You know, I'd say this. I'm looking back at the first two Batmans. I've got a lot of criticisms about how goofy or dumb some of them are, but they're still good. But now we got to talk about two of the worst Batman movies ever.
Hard left turn. Very hard left turn.
Yep. So let's talk about Batman Forever. Now, with Batman Forever, I will say this. More people will say that Batman and Robin is what destroyed the Batman franchise. I strongly disagree. I say Batman Forever is a much more worse movie than Batman and Robin.
Well, I mean, you couldn't have had Batman and Robin without Batman Forever, that's for sure. I don't recall as much to be able to qualify that one's worse than the other. I mean, my memory says Batman and Robin is worse, but I don't have any recent evidence to back that up.
Batman Forever did make a good amount of money, which is why I feel that people look at it more positively than Batman and Robin. But to kind of explain what happens with Batman Forever, Burton's out. They basically say, because of all the violence, we're going to have to change this. We're going to take you out. And they bring in Joel Schumacher. Now, Schumacher says, I'm going to try to embrace more of the old, goofier, campier style Batman.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if Batman and Batman Returns are kind of built on, like, as far as visually, like, blacks and grays and the noir look, this is much more colorful.
It used all the neon that existed in the 90s.
And use that, if Batman and Batman Returns are a dark, seedy bar, then Batman Forever and Batman and Robin are the neon lights that are outside.
There was some person that made millions of dollars because they owned all of these neon paints and black lights.
Yeah.
And Joel Schumacher said, hey, I'll buy them all from you. And he's like, I'm retiring now. Thank you. So they took Burton off, and with Burton off, they also had Keaton, who decided not to reprise his role, and it's probably the smart move that Keaton made on that point. So they decided who we're going to bring in to be Batman, and they decided, let's do Val Kilmer. Now, Val Kilmer, I like and respect when as an actor. There's a lot of movies that Val has done, which is great. You look at, obviously, Top Gun is where we broke out, and hey, good job there, Val Kilmer. Tombstone as Doc Holliday is downright legendary. His weird, quirky work, The Island of Dr. Moreau. One of my favorite movies that happened also a little after this was The Salton Sea, which is also a great movie. Here's the other things to know about Val Kilmer, though. Val Kilmer, from everything you read about, is also very difficult to work with, because Val, I wouldn't say is a method actor. Val is a guy that gets lost in his own head sometimes and has these weird visions of what he thinks certain characters are supposed to be. There was an article I read from Chuck Klosterman about how he interviewed Val Kilmer at Val Kilmer's ranch, and Val Kilmer said that because he does the role as an actor and because he's objectively outside the character itself, that he knows what it's like to be the character more than the character itself. Chuck was confused by this and had to ask him, well, what do you mean? Does that mean that you know what it's like to be a fighter pilot more than a fighter pilot themselves? And his response was, yes, because a fighter pilot only acts through instinct. I'm looking from the outside as well as a fighter pilot to understand their motivations and what they do. So yes, I do understand what it's like to be a fighter pilot more than a fighter pilot themselves. Val Kilmer, folks.
Yeah, and I think there's a small bit of validity. I wouldn't say you understand them more. I would say you understand them differently. Maybe you get a different insight, but I don't think that makes you understand them better than they understand themselves.
There was other things in that interview that were just weird about Val's approach or methodology of acting. But what I'll say is this, is that him as both Bruce Wayne and Batman, I don't know what the hell he was going for Bruce Wayne or Batman. His Bruce Wayne seems almost non-existent in, as a personality.
Yeah, almost like just bored with everything from what I remember.
Yeah, I mean, he just seems like, oh, everything is just talking like this, and I'm aloof, and I understand. And that was how his cadence of Bruce Wayne felt. His Batman really wasn't any different. I mean, his Batman was... It felt like you just had like this Val Kilmer mannequin that you just dressed up and various things, and then you just had him go out there. And maybe in Val Kilmer's mind, he's like, I'm killing this right now. I am the best Batman and Bruce Wayne. Nobody knows what it's like to be Batman and Bruce Wayne more than me.
Yeah.
So that was the first casting decision, which... as much as you could try to criticize Keaton wasn't sometimes given as much to work with, you know, in terms of like the first two movies, but you at least felt that Keaton had a direction or had something unique he was bringing to the table. I have no idea what the hell Val Kilmer was doing.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I think Keaton did a pretty good job despite the fact that, you know, nobody thought he could do it and thought he would do a good job. I feel like he did a pretty good job, whereas, yeah, like you said, I think Val Kilmer I don't know that I'd say he didn't know what he was doing, because I'm sure he knew exactly what he was doing. It just didn't quite work out.
Right. Or here's the other thing, too, is that was it also along the lines that Schumacher just didn't know how to deal with Val Kilmer? And, like, I can almost imagine where, like, Schumacher did, like, this, like, 10 to 15 takes of a certain scene, and he kept going to Val, I need you to do this. But he would just do the same thing every scene, and eventually Schumacher said,
screw it.
We're just going to go with this. So Kilmer was one of the first odd decisions to cast in this movie. The second oddest casting decision was Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face. Now, in the first Batman movie, Billy Dee Williams was in there as actually Harvey Dent. And since obviously they scrubbed a lot of the old, you know, who is what, and Harvey Dent would go on to become Two-Face. In this movie, they have Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face. But here's the thing, he's not Harvey Dent, nor do you ever see him ever portray Harvey Dent. He portrays Two-Face, who's basically, I gotta flip a coin to determine if I kill you or not. But there's no other aspect of Two-Face's personality. You never see a rational side of Two-Face.
No, he almost plays Two-Face almost like he's... like he really wanted to play Joker, but he couldn't get that line because he's kind of nuts, he's kind of crazy, and... almost the only defining Two-Face thing he does is flipping the coin, because the rest of him just seems way too over the top for Two-Face.
Right. Because, and here's where I'll touch back on the whole Tommy Lee Jones Two-Face thing in a second here, because the third casting choice, which is also equally bewildering, I understand the why. And in many ways, a lot of people say it works, was Jim Carrey as the Riddler. Now, Jim Carrey at this point is probably at one of the top points of his comedic career.
Prime Jim Carrey time right
here. You have Ace, you know, Ventura, you know, Pet Detective, you know, he's, you know, killing it there. You have, you know, all of these just, you know, The Mask. You have Jim Carrey that, you know, has established himself as the it comedy actor that you had to have in your movie. So they cast him as the Riddler. Now, this, I would say... if out of all the Batman movies, if you were to say that the first Batman was a Joker movie, the second movie, it was actually balanced. I don't think there's one character that dominated the screen time more than another in the second one.
Yeah, it was fairly spread out.
This movie, though, was a Riddler movie.
Yes.
This is a movie where, like, we are going to get as much as we can out of Jim Carrey at this point. And they have, like, the full-blown origin of how he becomes the Riddler. They have him becoming Bruce Wayne's rival. They have him, like, developing technologies in ways that are so cartoonish that it is almost out of, like, the 60s series. Now, touching back on Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones only did this movie because his son wanted Tommy Lee Jones, his dad, to be in a Batman movie. Tommy Lee Jones did not have any really prior knowledge of the characters or anything. He did this for his kid. So here's a fun anecdote that I read about that makes me laugh every time. Is that so? Tommy Lee Jones is at a restaurant, and this is shortly like before the production of Batman, Forever. And Jim Carrey goes to the restaurant and sees Tommy Lee Jones. So he goes over to Tommy Lee Jones and says, "Hey, just want to say it's going to be a great honor to work with you. I love, you as an actor. You're an amazing person." And Tommy Lee Jones just destroys Jim Carrey. He essentially goes to Carrey and says, "Listen, I don't have time for an imbecile or buffoon like you. I don't like you. I don't respect your work." It's like you're just completely oafish in how you do everything. I mean, he was just bashing Jim Carrey to his just face, straight out saying, "I will work with you, but I will not like or respect you as an actor."
Wow.
And, reading about it, like Jim Carrey walked away just hugely dejected and like, "Oh my God, what the hell just happened right there?" And it's interesting because you sit there and think, Tommy, you love your kid, but why did you do this movie? I mean, at no point during this movie, like how Two-Face is, Tommy can't be sitting there thinking, "I'm doing good." This whole movie, he has to be sitting there like, "Just doing it for the kid.
It's a
Just doing it
paycheck.
for
It's
the
a
kid."
paycheck. Yeah, and I feel like even story-wise, like you could completely take Two-Face out of this movie, from what I recall, I don't think it would make a bit of difference.
So, and I think that's the biggest problem, because we're going back to the whole issue where you have to have multiple villains in a Batman or any superhero movie. So here's your two villains. Now, the thing is that Two-Face is introduced from the start. And this is where, once again, I don't know what Two-Face's motivation is. So in the first scene of the movie, Batman stopping a robbery, he goes into the safe to get the security guard, but the door shuts and the guard sets a trap. The safe gets yanked out of the bank as if it's a single fixture and basically is being dangled by a helicopter, which can apparently hold the weight and load, all the load of like an entire vault,
That's a super helicopter there.
and has two people in it. And then Tommy Lee Jones activates a second part of his trap, which is acid that comes out of the deposit boxes. So let's talk about this for a second. Was Tommy Lee Jones trying to rob the bank, or was he trying to kill Batman?
It's hard to argue he's not trying to kill Batman primarily because, I mean, if you've got some kind of contraption that's feeding acid through all the boxes, I mean, you're not really going to make out with much loot if it's now completely dissolved in acid.
Right. I mean, it's one of those things that what if Batman had not shown up? Then what would have happened? Like, well,
Oh, well, I got this big safe.
Or let me ask this: did Tommy Lee Jones actually successfully rob the bank because he took all the money out of all the boxes, replaced them with acid?
Yeah, perhaps.
But I mean, that's just the problem right there. What was Tommy Lee Jones' motivation? Was it making money? Was it? Because you don't really ever know, because you never see a different side of Tommy Lee Jones. There's like another scene that's later in the movie where when the Riddler finds, Two-Face's like hideout, and they have it split down the middle, and one's this dingy, horrible, evil side, and the other side's this clean, pristine. And he even has two girlfriends. He has Drew Barrymore, who plays this like, nice, sweet girl. And then I think it was Deborah Messing that was playing this evil, wicked, girlfriend. And you sit there, and regardless, he's not acting like Harvey Dent at all. It's like, I'm Two-Face regardless of what the situation is. I'm this evil, messed up, deranged guy. And it's not like he's trying to get revenge on the mob for disfiguring him. It's not like he's trying to get revenge on Batman for something. You just don't know because
he's just kind of nuts.
He keeps robbing all these places. He's robbing a circus, for Christ's sake. And the whole motivation is like, I'm robbing the circus unless Batman gives himself up. Like, well, wait, then is your beef then with Batman? Or is it you're still robbing, you're still trying to get money? And then when he teams up with Jim Carrey, they're robbing jewelry stores and stuff. And once again, it's like, I don't know where you're going for right now.
Yeah, it's a very bizarre motivation. And probably leans more towards why you think this is a horrible movie more than Batman and Robin. But it's, either way, it's not a good movie. It's very cartoonish. It plays very much, it's almost like Schumacher had watched those Batman 66 reruns back when the original Batman movie came out. He's like, you know, I want to make a movie like those.
You know, and Jim Carrey's character arc is that, all right, I've developed this wave thing that can access people's brain waves, but then Bruce Wayne in Val Kilmer's weed, you know, this doesn't sound quite safe there. Edward, I don't think we can do this. And then that's where, like, you know, all of a sudden he's like, but Bruce Wayne, you were supposed to understand. And then he hates Bruce Wayne. And then he starts using his own technology against him, which makes him smarter. Then he makes his boss kill himself or throws him off, but frames it for suicide. And this is just where, once again, like, the whole line of rational is that, all right, hey, I used to be a Wayne Tech employee, but now I've created this massive new technology. If you're Bruce Wayne, you'd have to think that, all right, is he using information and stuff that's technically owned by us at Wayne Corp, because the fact that you developed it on our dime. So all it takes is a few cease and desist letters to take care of it from there. But then it gets even just weirder because, like, you see, like, the Riddler trying to become like Bruce Wayne, the suave guy. He steals Two-Face's Drew Barrymore girlfriend, and she's now his girlfriend, I guess. And then it just, he keeps, like, doing these things. Like, I'm going to have all these, like, clue riddles. I'll send the Bruce Wayne to terrorize him. And it's like, all right, so you hate Bruce Wayne, you worship Bruce Wayne. I don't know. His character is just, it basically, it's like, we just need to think up all these great Jim Carrey moments, and we're going to tie them together.
Yeah.
Like, one of the worst ones is when he screams joygasm and he throws, like, the hand grenade in the Batcave. I mean, then all of a sudden, like, Jim Carrey has, like, this weird island where they're storing all the brainwaves? I don't know. Yeah. And then from there, you have, like, you know, this just whole thing where then his mind gets melted and he forgets that Bruce Wayne is Batman, and it's messed up. I mean, so the recount right now, we have Val Kilmer, who could give a great performance but is basically sleepwalking through the film. We have Tommy Lee Jones that's begrudgingly doing the film and basically is just hamming it up like crazy. Which maybe in his mind he has to, because you have Jim Carrey, who right now is just all over the damn place. Now, let's tie in two other actors into this as well, because you have Chris O'Donnell, who's introduced then as Robin. So you have the whole circus thing where, hey, you show the death of, like, Chris O'Donnell's, Robin's parents, and then Bruce adopts a 22-year-old.
Yeah, he's definitely not, like, the young 13, 14-year-old or whatever that Robin is generally portrayed as when Bruce Wayne first crossed him. He's definitely an adult.
Right, so he has an adult, and he's like, you know, you'll be my ward. And like, okay, Bruce, that kind of seems really creepy right now. But then somehow Chris O'Donnell figures out that Bruce is Batman because there's this door that's always locked, and he acrobats his way into the door, into the Batcave, and steals the Batmobile and fights more neon criminals and villains. And
yeah, because apparently Bruce Wayne's secret identity is the worst kept secret ever.
Well, actually it is, because part of, like, earlier during the robbery that happens at the circus where Robin's parents die, the, you know, Two-Face is like, unless Batman gives himself up, then I'll kill everyone here, when he has the giant bomb. And then Val Kilmer's, like, sitting there screaming, and nobody can hear him because it's too noisy. He's like, all right, Batman! And nobody hears him because, so you wonder, though, there's, like, a guy running past him, like, wait, you are?
Yeah, you'd think there'd be somebody like, wait, I remember at that circus that one guy was yelling, why was Batman.
Why was Bruce Wayne yelling that he was Batman? It doesn't make any sense, but
wait a minute.
So, yeah, he was really horrible about, you know, keeping his identity. But so you have the whole Chris O'Donnell thing, which then becomes Robin. And they even shoehorn in, like, the whole holy joke, like, holy rock or whatever, because you know, because whatever it was, you got to have that classic throwback there. But you know, Alfred somehow had a Robin suit commission, and like, here you go, I'm all about it. So I'm not gonna focus too much on Chris O'Donnell. I mean, he was at a point in his career, he was a rising star, and I gotta say it was probably Batman that killed his.
Yeah, you're right. At the same time as he was rising, he then just as quickly descended.
Right. And then the last person I'm going to bring up is Nicole Kidman.
Yep.
So Nicole Kidman's character is even much more baffling. So you have a movie where you have Val Kilmer, Tommy Lee Jones. Now, you could disparage Jim Carrey as just a comedy actor, but you would see Jim Carrey go on to become a great serious actor. Too bad they didn't tap into that. And then you have Nicole Kidman. You're like, wow, what an amazing cast. Hey, Nicole Kidman, what's your... She's like sitting there like, you know, what's my character's motivation? You're just a horny psychiatrist that wants to fuck Batman. She's like, wait, what? It's like, yeah, you just want to bang Batman. That's really your whole motivation. You came to Gotham City because you're turned on by Batman. You're going to try to use the bat signal to seduce, you know, Batman. By the way, credit to all four Batman movies for having continuity of one character. What character was that?
Alfred.
Well, actually, you're right. Two characters.
Commissioner Gordon?
Yes. Pat Hingle to play Commissioner Gordon. So you have her like turning on the bat signal and say, like, the bat signal's not a beeper. She's like, I just want to tell you that Two-Face is motivated by his coin. He's like, I know that shit. And she's like, that's good. I like bats. And
you're kind of creepy, lady.
But that's her whole motivation. And he's trying, like, Bruce Wayne's, like, the story arc for Bruce Wayne is that he's trying to determine if he can be both Bruce Wayne and Batman. And, yeah, you can. It's not hard. You don't need to take a whole movie to figure that out. But he's trying to, like, date Nicole Kidman as Bruce Wayne, but she's into Batman. And
it's apparently the only person that can't figure out that they're the same person.
Right. It's impossible to figure out right there. So it's, you just sit there and like, poor Nicole. They just gave her like nothing to do. And it's like just a horny Batman groupie. It just felt really weird and messed up. Now, that being said, there is one thing that I would say is the unspoken star of this movie. And what is it?
I have no idea.
You don't know where I'm going to go with this one, because this one's going to kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, here comes a left field.
So, one Seal? Thing, I will say, the one thing that this movie did better than anybody else is that this is a movie where it decided to have an amazing soundtrack.
Yeah, now, I do remember that.
Now, this soundtrack right here, you had U2 on there, Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me. You had Kiss from a Rose from Seal, which...
Yep, that was the huge breakout single from the soundtrack.
Right, that was the song that karaoke would be like, you know, having that song every karaoke night, no matter where you go to. But, like, you look at who else was on the soundtrack as well. I remember, like, during one of the Joker scenes, you had the, not Joker, Riddler scenes, you had the Flaming Lips.
Yep.
You know, you got that. You had Method Man on there, Nick Cave. You had Brandy, PJ Harvey, Mazzy Star, Massive Attack.
It's almost like whoever was in charge of the soundtrack actually took their job seriously, whereas nobody else associated with the movie did whatsoever.
Right. I mean, it's Michael Hutchins of INXS before he felt a new sensation.
Yeah.
Yep, bad joke there. But, I mean, that's just the thing. It's like, you look at that soundtrack, it's like, you know what? They actually acquired quite a massive group of people to actually put out a soundtrack for the movie itself. More so than they probably had paid attention to the script. So, with Batman Forever, this is, I guess, my end tagline on this is that people can crap on Batman and Robin, but this movie is justifiably so much worse when you look at who was involved, how underutilized the talent it was, how much neon and how much goofiness there
is. Yeah, I mean, I would say even if you consider Batman and Robin to be a 10 on the crap meter, this is easily an 8 or 9, you know, even if you're not, don't subscribe to your idea that this is worse than the other, it's right up there with it.
It's hard. I mean, there's, for somebody to say that, I can understand why somebody would say Batman and Robin, because when we talk about that in a second, there's things that are very groan-worthy, but there's a reason I'm going to give Batman and Robin a pass. So, going to Batman and Robin. So, with Batman and Robin... who is the top billed star of Batman and Robin?
I'm going to guess it's probably Arnold Schwarzenegger.
His name is the first one that comes up during the overall like opening credits.
Yeah, and I think if I remember right, even on the poster, he's like top and center of the poster. Even
oh,
the
yeah.
Movie poster.
So,
Mr. Freeze.
They bring in the big guns. They bring in Arnold, who is also, you know, near the height of his star power, making blockbusters left and right.
Yeah, you could argue this is the start of his downfall, though.
This, you could probably say, like, yeah... After this, he would just kind of fade out for a while until, like, the Expendables came back into play. But with Arnold here, he got top billing. Val Kilmer didn't come back. I don't know if they didn't ask him back or if not. They bring in George Clooney. George yes. Clooney is actually, in my opinion, the best Bruce Wayne out of all the Batmans.
And I would agree with you there. I think... Clooney got kind of short shrift by having been stuck on this film, and I know he kind of he personally tends to take a lot of the heat himself. Like, if you ask him, he'll apologize left and right for Batman Robin being a horrible movie, but I don't think it's his fault. I think he did a great job. I remember when he was cast, I remember being kind of excited about it. I think he does great as Bruce Wayne. He does good as Batman with, you know, with what he's given.
He's convincing as a million billionaire in the sense that he has that kind of charm or the ability to kind of disarm people with, you know, his words, which Val Kilmer didn't have. And with Michael Keaton always just seemed like he had a chip on his shoulder for some reason.
Yeah, he just seemed way too depressed, I think, all the time.
And as Batman... He wasn't a bad Batman. I mean, compared to like what Val Kilmer's Batman is, he was clearly better than Val Kilmer's. And would you say he's better than Keaton?
I'd say he's at least on par with Keaton. He might be better than him, but I think his Bruce Wayne just outshines everybody else's so much more that, you know.
You know, and at that point right there, he was right getting into like his series of movies, because I think a year or so later, that's when he did Three Kings.
And yeah, I feel like this was a little bit of a stumbling block, because I don't know if it was his first movie outside of ER, but it was definitely one of the first ones, and this was clearly supposed to be his big breakout movie.
Right.
And it obviously didn't end up happening that way, so I'm kind of glad he got past this and ended up having a career, because it could have easily just as easily destroyed his career as anything else.
And he recovered pretty well, because this was 98. He did Three Kings, which I want to say was 99 or 2000. Yeah. And then 2001, that was like Ocean's 11. So
yeah.
he basically said, all right, I made a horrible movie here.
I think
he completely recovered from
that. I think he recovered well, which I think goes to show just how much of a talent he is and how good of an actor he is that he recovered from this debacle.
Now you have the return of Chris O'Donnell, which he has that going for him.
He's there.
He sure is there. Now you have multiple villains, and there are a lot of villains.
Yeah, I can think of three, but it's entirely possible.
I can think of four.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's entirely possible that there's more.
All right. So we've already talked about Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze, and that's, is he your primary villain? I don't know.
I think he's intended to be, but I think he shares the stage with somebody else, definitely.
The problem is that, like, one of the best portrayals of Mr. Freeze, I'm going to go back to the Batman animated series, because you have a guy that's cold and emotionless, but that's because he lost his wife, you know, and because of how he lost his wife and how he adopted the persona, he's just a stiff, cold person. He's not this, like, goofy, like, quipping machine like Arnold is, where, like, you know, like, there's... You could find, like, I think, like, YouTube, like, 3-4 minute YouTube clips of, like, all the puns that Arnold did.
Oh, it's just, he's just a pun-spouting machine. They took a character that the animated series basically built him up, because I don't believe he appeared in the comics much, if I remember right. I think he basically hadn't appeared much since the original TV show, where he was basically nothing. Turned him into this great, tragic villain with motivations and everything, and then the movie almost came along, like, oh, you've got this great character, we're going to turn it on its head and turn him into a pun-spouting idiot.
Oh, and that's part of the problem, is because the movie then tries to make him sympathetic later down the line, where it's like, hey, you know, but he's doing this because of his wife, and guess what? The disease Alfred has, which we'll groan about later, this also is the same type of disease your wife had, and you can find a way to cure the disease.
Yeah.
Good for you. So you got Mr. Freeze as your first villain. Your second primary villain, now this is Uma Thurman, who's coming off of Pulp Fiction. She had, I think, two other movies around that time.
This is kind of prime Uma Thurman time here.
Right. And she plays Pamela Ivey, a.k.a. Poison Ivy. Now, her portrayal of Poison Ivy is where it's like, if like the best way I'd explain it is if Uma Thurman traveled into the future and watched RuPaul's Drag Race and said, "That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make Poison Ivy act like the biggest drag queen of all time." Now, she's supposed to be this big brassy woman, like this, like, what's her name? Ma West type of character, where she, you know, she's big, bold, and empowered. But she also goes through like the same sort of character arc that Catwoman did. She's this squeaky mousy character until all it takes is something traumatic, and then guess what? I'm sexy now.
Yeah, because you know, in order for a woman to be bold and powerful, they have to have something traumatic happen to them, right?
Right. Now, her creation is also at the hands of what I consider the third villain, which, you know, is just a sub-villain. Woodrow Wilson. You know who Woodrow... You don't follow DC as much as I did.
No, the name slightly rings a bell.
He became Plant Man in DC Comics. Yeah. I mean, he was... He's actually not as bad of a character. He actually shows up in Starman. I don't know if you ever read Starman.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Good remember. Stuff.
Yeah, he's in there. So, okay. I mean, he had... He's... Left on his own, yeah, he seems lame, but he has some things definitely going for him. But, yeah, he was in there, and he was the reason for the creation. And that was because he was creating the Super Soldier Serum, which created villain number four.
Bane!
Who, Bane, oh, man,
it's bad.
Basically, like, the best way I can describe how Bane was in Batman and Robin, I don't know if you... how far have you watched into Arrested Development?
I haven't seen the Netflix seasons.
All right. Well, I'm mixed on those, but there is that in the Netflix seasons, even the regular season, there was the episode where George Michael was going to portray, they were doing the nativity scene. Remember where he was going to be God touching?
Yeah, yep.
And he's wearing like the bodysuit. Well, in like the Netflix seasons, it becomes a running joke where he starts wearing that all the time because it makes him look buffer, or even the regular season makes him look stronger and tougher.
Yeah.
That's what Bane almost reminds me of. He's like George Michael basically wearing like this inflated puffy suit to try to look stronger.
He looks as overly cartoonish as this entire movie and the last one, where Bane, I feel like, just outdoes both of those.
So you have Bane, who's there as just a muscle, and I can't even remember what happened to him in the movie.
It almost makes you wonder why they bothered putting him there, because they could have just had him be like nameless thug too, because he's basically a flunky of Poison Ivy's.
Well,
and he doesn't really do anything, I don't feel, to distinguish himself as anything other than that. You couldn't have just had a random flunky be.
It does such a great disservice to Bane, because in the comics, Bane's positioned as basically Batman's equal in a physical sense. Not only that, but also in how he calculated his. Bane's only downfall in the comic is his reliance on the Venom and how his overconfidence and overuse of it. You know, but he was the guy that played chess with, you know, Bruce Wayne, Batman in the comics, and won on multiple occasions. Yes. So they have him as this, like, mindless beast that basically just kind of follows Poison Ivy around like a puppy dog.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know why they bought... It was almost like they were like, we need a third villain for this, or a fourth villain or whatever. We need somebody else in here. Like, oh, let's put Bane in here. He can be one of Poison Ivy's people.
Right. So you have all these villains in there, and once again... The biggest problem I have with this whole Batman series of movies is you don't know what the motivations of the characters are. So you have Arnold, who's technically trying to get diamonds or the way to try to save his wife. But the problem is that it doesn't feel like that. Like, you have him saying one thing, but you look at his actions and everything, and it's like, well, I guess he's doing that. You have Poison Ivy, who wants to save Earth and basically teams up with Mr. Freeze for reasons. Because I don't know, I can't remember how she was going to advance her cause.
Yeah, and I certainly don't remember, but it's almost like they were just like, well, they have to team up at some point because they're in the same movie.
The third, or if you want to say what the fifth villain is in the movie, it's the disease that's going to kill Alfred.
Yeah.
So they reveal
Uncle Alfred.
Yeah, good old Uncle Alfred. So one of the other big changes they had is they introduced Barbara, but she's not Barbara Gordon, where, you know, she becomes eventually Batgirl, and instead she's Alfred's niece. So it's weird enough that, you know, hi, Uncle Alfred, I'm going to show up, and guess what? I'm part of your life now. Like, oh, that's great, but I'm not feeling too well because of the McGregor disease.
And yeah.
So then they find out Alfred's dying, and that... Mr. Freeze holds it, and once again, her motivation—I that's the thing—is like she goes out in like the middle of the night and she does these midnight illegal street races, and so you learn that way. She's this person that's not as good as you think she is. Doesn't seem to have a motivation for justice or anything. She just seems to love Alfred and love street racing.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty Fast and the Furious.
And then you have Robin. It's like, I'm kind of into you, but we're kind of rivals at this point, but maybe we're not rivals. But the problem is that that plot with like Robin too is like, I'm not just rivals to you. I'm also kind of a rival with Batman because Batman gets all the women and I want to get with the women because I think I love Poison Ivy because of her pheromone thing she did, and it just gets muddy. I mean, this is where the movie has too many things going on in it. But this is why I give the movie a pass compared to Batman Forever. I feel at least this movie acknowledges that, hey, this is going to be a stupid movie. We know that this is going to be this, like the third movie, Batman Forever, still felt like he was trying to cling on to like some of the old Burton stuff. This one's like, you know what? This is a goddamn cartoon.
This is going to be a stupid, goofy mess, and we know that, and we're going to play up to that.
We're just going to embrace this at this point. We're going to embrace that Batman and Robin are going to have skates built into their shoes, and they're going to get into a hockey game with, you know, Mr. Freeze and his thugs. We're going to embrace that, you know, Mr. Freeze is going to have giant drills that shoot rockets into the space, and then that's what happens with that. We're going to embrace that, you know, for some reason, like Bruce, like Batman and Robin are at a charity thing, and they have all of these different big people there. You have Uma Thurman, who's dressed up as a gorilla, then unzips and basically like there's all these people like, I'll bid this much money for her, Rio, and it becomes this weird, just campy thing of just, all right, this isn't serious, but it's not pretending to be serious. It's really just this goofy of a goddamn thing. And
Yeah, you can. It's still just a hot mess, though.
it's still a mess. I agree. It's just as much of a mess as Batman Forever. I blame Batman Forever more than Batman and Robin, though, because I feel that they just started this and they said, you know what? Screw it. We're just gonna screw with this at this point. And, you know, we're gonna remake the formula. And they broke the Batman formula, and then all that Batman and Robin is doing is just following the same thing because there's still the overuse of neon in there. There's still
Oh,
the
yeah.
weird character motivations. Like, what's Batman's story arc? I think Batman's story arc is that he has a like long-term girlfriend that she wants him to settle down, but he doesn't know if he's gonna settle down. And
Yeah, and I don't remember enough to know what exactly his whole deal was. It's a bizarre movie, and I also feel like we can't go this whole thing without mentioning the bat nipples or the bat credit card.
the bat credit card, the bat nipples, the ass shots of like the bat armor.
Yeah, oh yeah, the ass shot, yep.
It's the same sort of thing right there where once again it's like the bat credit card. If you're a bank and like, you know, Batman, the guy calls up, yes, I'm Batman, I want to have my own credit card issued through you, and like we can wait, what?
Okay, we just need an address. Oh, I can't give that to you.
Or did Bruce Wayne create like an ATM credit card that basically reroutes for all these like several banks so it's untraceable and then just taps out of his own personal fortune?
it's probably best not to think about what the deal with that is.
So yeah, it's once again, it's just that hard line of where the movie goes all over the place itself. I would say this is that as a collective, all four of the movies aren't really that great. I mean, well, I'll say Forever and Rob, Batman and Robin are both obviously just horrendous pieces of garbage. But even with like Returns and like first one, there's a lot of horrible flaws that we were willing to overlook. And I think the reason we were willing to overlook those flaws is because there was a void. There was basically nothing
Yes.
else out during that time to compare it
It
to.
was, yeah, I mean, they were basically the only comic book movies you had at the time, so it was that or nothing. So when they came out and they were actually halfway decent at the time was, you know, still a 10 at the scale for the time. Whereas now that we've had so much more, and you look back at it, you're like, oh, those really aren't all that great compared to what we have now.
The 90s was weird when you think about like how many different comic book movies were being made, but quality was definitely like, I remember, let's see, the mid 90s, you had The Mask, you had Barb Wire, which, oh God, that was horrible.
Oh God.
You had Tank Girl.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting that the comic book movies that got made in the 90s were all these weird aside from Batman, were all these independent, smaller press type comics, you know, whereas you didn't get the bigger, like, Spider-Man and X-Men until, like, almost 2000.
It doesn't surprise me in some sense, though, because Marvel had their rights split up. They sold their movie rights, a lot of them in the 80s, to so many different studios that it made it harder for those movies to get made because those rights were tied up
elsewhere. That's true. I do remember Spider-Man was tied up for quite a while, and that probably would have came out a lot sooner if it wasn't in such a hot legal mess.
I mean, that's why there was such a horrible Fantastic Four movie made in the mid-90s, was just because the rights were going to run out of the movie, so they had to release a movie just to retain the rights.
Yeah.
I mean, you had even the Punisher movie that happened around that time.
Dolph Lundgren.
Yep. Don't forget that really bad Captain America movie that happened around 89 or 90.
Yep.
So, I mean, superhero movies were coming out in just massive droves around that period of time in the 90s, but I wouldn't say that they were necessarily good. And now, before going on to this, one other just quick call out here too. The soundtrack for Batman and Robin, not quite as good as Batman Forever, but you still have The End Is the Beginning and The End by the Smashing Pumpkins, which was used also in the Watchmen trailers, and that was actually a decent song. You had Gotham Kelly by Mr. Piss, or R. Kelly himself. You had R.E.M. Jewel, Soul Coughing. And that's it. The rest of it was like orchestral music I had on there too, so They had an okay soundtrack, but not as good as Batman Forever. But I think where the 90s ended and where the 2000s took over is when Marvel finally got Spider-Man out there. And Marvel's Spider-Man changed it in the sense that it at least felt that Marvel's Spider-Man was in a more realistic world than
Well, I think it was Spider-Man and I think
Daredevil.
Did Spider-Man come out first or was it X-Men? Because I know
They're
all kind of right around the same time.
But it was X-Men, Spider-Man, then I think Daredevil.
Yeah, from Daredevil like 2000,
came out 2001, 2002. And I think that's where it showed, hey, you can have the movie grounded. And I think that's the one thing that none of the Batman movies ever were, was they were never grounded in a sense of reality. There was always some absurd aspect to those movies where you had to sit there and kind of suspend your disbelief a little.
They were superhero movies, but you kind of watch them, you know, it's kind of taking place in the real world, but at the same time, like, this is not our universe. Whereas I think when X-Men and Spider-Man came out, you were like, yeah, this could maybe be our, you know, I mean, it's obviously not, but this could feasibly happen in our world.
Right. You have the first Batman where it's like, hey guys, I'm going to try to kill the town with poison balloons. All right. That seems kind of weird.
Yeah.
You have the second Batman movie. We got rocket shooting penguins. Like, all right. That's also equally weird. Third Batman movie, we got this super brainwave sucking machine box that like goes on your TV and makes you think you're fishing. All right, that's messed up. And then you have Mr. Freeze trying to freeze all of Gotham City and other dumb things happening.
Yeah, they're just very cartoonish, very, as much as I hate the cliche comic booky type plots.
But then, yeah, you get to the 2000s and X-Men showed that, hey, look, we can make a realistic looking movie right here. And then Spider-Man said, look, we can also make a realistic looking movie and also make Tobey Maguire try to look like a star. And then Daredevil's like, look, we can try to make it look like Ben Affleck and be a star. And by the way, Ben Affleck, Charlie Cox is a 15 times better Daredevil than you ever are.
Oh, yes.
So I think that's kind of just why, you know, looking back at like these Batman movies, it's funny in the sense of how important they are. We wouldn't have any of the things we probably would have right now in comic book movies if it wasn't for what Batman did back then. But it doesn't necessarily mean that Batman did it well back then. It did it well for what it was in its time.
Yeah, I agree. They kind of started out for, like you said, well for its time. It definitely went off the rails. But I also don't think that if these movies, the first couple at least, didn't do as well as they did, it wouldn't have caused anybody, you know, like, they wouldn't have been like, hey, maybe we should make an Iron Man movie. Maybe we should make an X-Men movie or Spider-Man. You know, none of that stuff would, I think, be on the table if these had flopped, you know, or at least it would have happened considerably later.
Well, and it's an interesting, weird story arc, too, without turning this into, like, a total review of all comic book movies, is that when X-Men came out, X-Men, like, was kind of, like, had the same impact as the first Batman. Like, oh, crap, here's all these awesome things going on, and it's things that people weren't expecting to see. But then as the X-Men franchise went on, it got sillier and sillier.
Yeah, it definitely started to go off the rails again.
It went off the rails. Like, the first, like, you know, X-Men, it's like, all right, they're fighting Magneto, who's trying to use the Statue of Liberty to turn everybody into mutants. Well,
Yeah.
I guess it's not poison gas in Gotham City, but it's also still kind of a weird aspect. But it felt better because it was grounded. The second X-Men movie, I think, felt better just because you took the ineffective Cyclops Jason Marsden out of the equation. You just had to be more of a Wolverine Storm-led movie at that point.
And, yeah.
You know, that movie, you know, kind of felt awesome with all the Weapon X elements. But then the third, you know, but the whole plot of the second movie is we're going to use a mutant kid to mentally kill all non-mutants. And then once again, you say that aloud, it's like, that seems kind of really weird and cartoony again.
It's, yeah, but the way they pull it off, I think, makes it work.
The third movie is just...
Oh, just, yeah.
Yeah, we won't talk there. And, you know, I'm not even going to give even the new X-Men movies a pass either because I liked First Class for what it was, but there were some parts in there that seemed definitely kind of weird and out of place.
Yeah, and almost like the Batman movies, as they've progressively gone on, they seem like they've gone more off the rails.
I, honestly, after First Class, like I remember seeing Days of Future Past of the X-Men, and I thought, this is weird because it's a movie where they're intensely murdering all the X-Men, but they're doing it more for shock value versus for...
Yeah, it was not a horrible movie, but it definitely was... You could start to see the decline there.
Right, and then I watched the other X-Men movies, and those are all horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I'm not going to give Tobey Maguire a pass. Spider-Man was great when it came out, but that was once again because we had such low expectations. Tobey Maguire never could play a good Spider-Man. Like, at first, like, when, like, Andrew Garfield took over as Spider-Man, I'm like, you know what? He's got the quipping part down. That's one thing that, like, Tobey Maguire couldn't. It was like having, like, this dork try to, like, you know, talk trash to you. Like, oh, Tobey Maguire. But once again, those Spider-Man movies also, once again, didn't make a lot of sense in some ways. Like Willem Dafoe, you know, all right, he was a great villain, but he didn't really get his motivation except trying to get his company back, I guess.
Something, yeah.
You had Dr. Octopus, the second Spider-Man movie, at least, of Tobey Maguire's was the best.
Yes.
You know, that's easy to say right there. Probably one of the better ones in general in terms of handling everything. I won't talk about the third Spider-Man.
No.
That's horrible.
But anyway, but we digress.
Yeah, we digress.
Well, we can make that a whole other episode.
Yeah, I think that's the hard thing is that the more that you talk about, like, future superhero movies, when you look at the origins of this, like, when you, if you were to show a kid as an example right now, if you were to go to your kid Alec and say, hey, here's Iron Man, which came out in 2008, and here's Batman that came out in 1989.
Yeah, Iron Man, I think he would definitely dig. I think he'd watch Batman 89 and he would be bored to tears, I think.
Right, because it's just weird, like, just... It's harder to understand, so. So, in general, the original Batman movies, not as good as you'd think. There's redeeming values in them. MVP of each movie is this. MVP of, let's say, the first Batman movie, I know you could say it would be the Joker. I would probably say it's probably Knox, because he's an everyman character. It has probably a better realistic view of things. Your second movie, your MVP of that movie, would definitely have to be Max Schreck with Walken, and he's the MVP of all that series, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The third movie, there is zero MVP in that third movie.
Yeah, it's kind of a hot mess.
Actually, the MVP of that third movie, I would say, is the guy in the beginning in the vault. The guy that was the hostage. The reason why is because he gives like 5 minutes of exposition telling Batman everything, and it's like, acid! Oh no, there's this! And then he has, like, fortunately, like, a hearing aid that Batman can use to crack the safe from the inside, so way to go, unnamed guard. You're the MVP of that one, and MVP and Batman and Robin, oh.
End credits?
The end credits. No, I'm sorry, I take that back. The MVP of a Batman Forever, that would be Seal.
Yeah, the soundtrack.
The soundtrack's the MVP of that one. The MVP of probably Batman and Robin. I'm going to actually give it to a Batman. I'm going to give it to George Clooney. Good way to go, George. You worked with the best you had. And
yeah, I kind of feel bad for him.
Poor George. So thank you, everybody, for taking the time to listen. If you have any differing opinions about what you feel about Batman, by all means, feel free to speak back at me. I'm sure a lot of people probably say that Batman and Robin's worse, and I'm not going to hate that opinion. I just still feel that Batman Forever is a much, much worse movie. So that's all I got for right now. Thank you for listening, and tune back in for our next episode. Maybe I'll have another one out within a month. Dare to Dream.
Bye, everyone.